Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio. Unplug, strap yourself in, because you are about to move beyond the matrix.
Sometimes moving beyond the matrix can be a challenge, but here we're going to make it easy for you to move beyond the matrix, because we're going to provide you with content that is going to give you more information to make decisions and to have views that are balanced and full of truth. We are sponsored by TorahLearningChannel.com. That is TorahLearningChannel.com, the official sponsor of Beyond the Matrix. It is a 24/6 Torah learning source for you, for kosher Torah learning. Tune in today. Go see it on the internet, TorahLearningChannel.com, and it will soon be available on Amazon Fire and Roku. And we'll tell you about that later. Jerry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Yeah, good. That's nice. It's just fine. It's just fine.
Just fine. That tells you I am cautiously optimistic.
Okay, well, me too. Look, we have a lot of things that have been going on in the news cycle, and we wanted to bring back a very special guest that we had a couple of weeks ago, actually. And it's Dr. Raphael Madoff, director of the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. And the reason why is, as soon as we did this show, there were several articles that came out, pro and con, about the subject matter that we talked about. So we thought we'd bring him back on to the show and discuss some of that. Why don't you give the listener just a little bit of intro into what we're going to do?
Well, basically, part of the reason for having Dr. Madoff back is there's the opening, essentially, of an exhibit at the U.S. Memorial Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., that has generated the usual set of controversy about the content. Dr. Madoff talked about one of the controversial issues last time, and that's the whole bombing Auschwitz issue and the remarks of a staffer.
Okay, well, good. We're going to be attacking that in just a little bit. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. As soon as we come back, we'll have Dr. Madoff available for this open discussion on Holocaust studies. Don't go away. We'll be right back after these messages.
This is Ari Folder. I want to invite you all to join me on my weekly show, Bulletproof, here on Israel News Talk Radio. It's the weekly show we discover, expose, and destroy all anti-Israel propaganda that's spread throughout the universe, both from outside Israel, including also inside Israel. Join me every week, and let's defend Israel together.
Bulletproof. Live every Sunday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. U.S. Eastern time.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Back from the break. Thank you so much for sticking around. We are listening, you are listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Jerry, our very special guest that you actually brought on a couple of weeks with us, we want to revisit the issue or the issues that came about from an article that was written just a few weeks ago. And Dr. Madoff is our residential expert on this whole idea, director of David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. Jerry, I'm going to bump it over to you and let you start with the first question.
Dr. Madoff, Edward Rothstein had a review of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum exhibit entitled Americans in the Holocaust, What We Could Have Done, in the Wall Street Journal. What are the relevance of his review and your own criticism of this exhibit?
Well, Edward Rothstein's article in the Wall Street Journal mentioned a number of points which are really at odds with the historical record. That is a number of aspects about the new exhibit at the U.S. Holocaust Museum concerning Americans' responses to the Holocaust. Just to give you one example, in the article, he said, and I'm quoting here, after late 1941, there was no escape. Germany banned Jewish emigration from its territories. And there's a similar claim in the exhibit itself, which I saw the other day. And there's a panel in the exhibit where the text states, and I'm quoting again, with America at war, Jews seeking to emigrate had almost no chance to escape. Well, this is simply untrue. The idea that that nobody could escape from Europe once America got into the war is simply at odds with the facts. You know, Hitler's Europe was not hermetically sealed during World War II. There were many Jews who escaped. Obviously, it was harder. But just for example, more than 26,000 European Jews reached Palestine, Eretz Israel, between 1941 and 1944. These were transports that were organized by underground Zionist activists. So there's 26,000 people who escaped. There were about 27,000 Jewish refugees who managed to escape to Switzerland during the war, and they were granted haven. There were, incidentally, tens of thousands of other Jews who reached the border with Switzerland, but were turned away by the Swiss authorities. That's a separate issue, but it shows again that it was possible in many instances to escape. We all know the famous story about the mass escape of Jews from Denmark. Over 7,000 Danish Jews were smuggled out of Nazi-occupied Denmark into Sweden in 1943, right in the middle of World War II. There were thousands of French Jews who escaped from the deportations in France and made it into Spain. There were thousands of Jewish refugees who reached Italy after it was liberated by the Allies in 1943. So this whole notion that it was impossible to escape is something which is being promoted by people who want to argue that there's nothing that President Roosevelt really could have done to help the Jews because, you know, once Hitler controlled the continent, then nobody could get out. So don't blame FDR. But the truth is that there were ways to escape. There were people who escaped in various ways, as the ones, as like the examples I just mentioned. And if the United States government, if the Roosevelt administration had shown some will, some humanitarian will to help rescue Jews from the Holocaust, ways could have been found to rescue many more of them. And it's very disappointing that a venerated institution such as the United States Holocaust Museum should propagate a notion which is demonstrably false. And it's a pity that the Wall Street Journal's author, Edward Rothstein, should just pick that up and repeat it without questioning it. But historians have written about the escape of Jews from Europe during World War II many times in the past. It's not like I'm revealing some secret. These are well-known, established historical facts, which are unfortunately being pushed aside by people who want to whitewash President Roosevelt's record on the Holocaust.
Are you the only one that is challenging this idea, or are there others out there very vocally challenging this information?
Well, actually, it's the other way around. The majority of historians who work in this field have been very critical of President Roosevelt's response to the Holocaust and have written extensively about his abandonment of the Jews and demonstrated the historical record, which is completely at odds with what the U.S. Holocaust Museum is now pushing. Now, the field of American responses to the Holocaust is a relatively narrow field, which is to say there are probably less than a dozen established scholars who are continuing to do new research in the area. And almost all of those scholars are affiliated with the David Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. So the majority opinion among historians who are actually working in this area is very critical of President Roosevelt's response. And the notions that are being pushed by the Holocaust Museum are really a radical position that is at odds with what most historians have found.
Dr. Medoff, why is the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum taking this particular stand and conflicting with the historical evidence?
Well, I can't speak to the motives of the individuals at the museum who have shaped this exhibit and written the text, because to begin with, that's not public information. There's no list on the Holocaust Museum's website of who wrote which parts of the exhibit. We know the names of the curators, but There are obviously staff members at the Holocaust Museum who have made a decision to present President Roosevelt in a new and more flattering light. As for their motives, it's impossible to know. People who take these kinds of positions may be coming from a variety of angles. I don't want to speculate as to what their motives might be. They certainly have not commented on that. They have simply created a new multi-million dollar razzle-dazzle exhibit courtesy of U.S. taxpayers' money, which funds the museum. They presented a certain perspective, which is clearly at odds with major parts of the historical record. And I'm responding, and my colleagues are responding to these misstatements as we would any historical debate. And I imagine this will be a debate that will continue for some time. But again, it's a debate which has arisen not because historians at the Holocaust Museum have discovered some new documents that exonerate President Roosevelt. If they had, this would be a much more legitimate discussion. There are no new documents that show that. On the contrary, all of the new research that has been done over the past decade or more about President Roosevelt's response to the Holocaust has shown him to have been even less concerned about the Jews and have made even less efforts than we might have thought before. Everything that has been discovered in the archives in recent decades paints an even less flattering portrait of President Roosevelt's response. So this is not a discussion arising from the discovery of new documents. This is a debate that has been has begun because people at the museum have, for whatever reason, decided to take a partisan position based on considerations other than the historical record.
Turning to one of the books that you and the late David Wyman had written about this era in the United States, Race Against Death, Peter Bergson, America and the Holocaust, you tell the story of the unrequited honor due the Bergson boys and the battle to save European Jews during the Shoah here in the United States. Who were Peter Bergson and his cohorts? What did they achieve, and why haven't Yad Vashem and the U.S. Holocaust Memorial recognized them?
Peter Bergson and a group of his colleagues were young Zionist activists in British Mandatory Palestine and in Europe during the 1930s. And they were involved primarily in smuggling Jews out of Europe in the 30s into Palestine in defiance of British immigration restrictions. And they saved tens of thousands of lives. In 1940, this small group of activists came to the United States, where they began a campaign to try to rouse public interest in the idea of creating a Jewish army and a Jewish state. As news about the mass slaughter of the Jews in Europe began reaching the U.S. in 1941, especially in 1942, this Bergson group shifted their attention to the issue of trying to rescue Jews from the Holocaust. And they did this through a series of very unorthodox protest tactics. I should say unorthodox for that time. They took out full-page ads in the newspapers, which was something American Jewish organizations did not do in those days. They staged rallies. They recruited prominent celebrities to support the cause of rescue. They organized a march by 400 Orthodox rabbis to the White House in the autumn of 1943. That was the only time during the entire Holocaust period that there was a march in Washington to plead for rescue of the Jews. These kinds of tactics by the Bergson Group were very successful in terms of making the American public aware of the slaughter of the Jews. These tactics were successful in putting pressure on the Roosevelt administration to try to do something, but they also discomfited many of the established American Jewish leaders who felt that these kinds of forthright tactics might cause anti-Semitism.
That is that's going to be a great lead up into the 1943 Gallup poll that revealed Americans' ignorance on the whole issue. It's kind of a nice lead-in into the next segment. So if you can kind of keep that thought, we'll add to it, and then we'll go into the next question that we have for you. You listen to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Don't go away. We have Dr. Rafael Madoff, Director David S. Wyman, Institute for Holocaust Studies. Don't go away. We'll be right back after these messages.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country. From Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Jerry and I really want to let you know how much we appreciate you listening to Beyond the Matrix each week and making it a part of your education and information. Tor Learning Channel is our official sponsor for Beyond the Matrix. We'd like you to take time to go by and visit 24 hours a day kosher learning for your enjoyment. Some of the best English teachers in the world are available 24 hours a day, TorahLearningChannel.com. And if you would like to send us some input, some information about what you would like to hear on the program, make sure you send us an email, rod@IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com, rod@IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Jerry, let's take it up to the next question.
At the start of 1943, 2 million Jews had already been murdered in Europe. What did a 1943 Gallup poll reveal about American ignorance of the Holocaust?
Well, it showed that many Americans still did not know or did not believe that the mass murder of the Jews in Europe was going on, even though a month earlier, the Allied governments had all issued a joint declaration confirming that what they called the mass extermination of the Jews was underway. Now, this was exactly the problem that the Bergson Group confronted when they began their activist campaign to promote the idea of trying to rescue Jews from the Holocaust. This is the first problem they faced, was that most Americans didn't know or didn't believe that it was happening. A major reason that there was so much ignorance and disbelief among the public at that point was that the major American daily newspapers regularly buried news about the mass killings in the back pages, if they publish it at all. The definitive study of how the New York Times covered the Holocaust is titled Buried by the Times. The book is by Professor Laurel Leff from Northeastern University. And it shows how the editors of the New York Times deliberately downplayed news about the mass killings. That's one of the reasons why the Bergson Group had to take out full-page ads in the newspapers. They sponsored more than 200 full-page ads between 1941 and 1945, precisely in order to combat the ignorance among the public that was being fostered by the woefully inadequate coverage of newspapers like the New York Times. But it's also important to note that there was a shift in public opinion. Until that point, into 1943, you had, first of all, a lot of ignorance about what was happening to the Jews. And you also had very strong public opposition to more refugee immigration to the United States. And this is a point, by the way, which is emphasized again and again in the new exhibit at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, that there was so much opposition among the public to immigration that really there was very little President Roosevelt could do. He couldn't defy overwhelming public sentiment. But it's very important to know that there was a shift in public opinion later in 1943. And it happened for several very specific reasons. First of all, the tide of the war began to turn after the defeat of the Germans at Stalingrad, after the liberation of Italy by the Allies, and other military advances By late 1943, it was becoming increasingly clear that the Allies were going to win the war. And that that was a very important factor in making ordinary Americans more willing to consider the idea of giving some kind of a haven to Jewish refugees. In the spring of 1944, the White House commissioned a Gallup poll to ask the public, would they be willing to grant temporary haven to refugees fleeing from the Nazis, to grant them haven in the United States? And the poll did not even specify a number, so it was a number of refugees. So it was in effect asking, should we allow in an unlimited number? You know, whoever is being persecuted, should we allow them to stay here temporarily, and then they'll go back after the war? The results were astonishing compared to polls in earlier years. 70% of Americans in April 1944 told Gallup that they would support granting temporary refuge to Jews fleeing from Europe. So this, too, is an important point exposing how wrong the new exhibit at the Holocaust Museum really is. Now, the exhibit, which I saw a few days ago, does not mention the poll that I just referred to. It talks about all the polls from the earlier years showing that the public was against immigration, but it does not reveal.
Wow.
You can call this deception by omission. It does not reveal that there was a significant change and that Gallup, commissioned by the White House itself, found 70% in favor of temporary refuge. So at that point, the spring of 1944, the war was not over. It ended. There was more than a year to go. Many Jews still could have been saved. President Roosevelt would have had strong public backing for temporary havens. Instead, he allowed just one group of 982 refugees to enter the U.S. later in 1944 and to live in a former army camp in upstate New York, in Oswego, New York. But he had the public support for it. So it's true that the public opposed immigration for many years, but it's equally important to realize when that changed and not to claim that it's the American public's fault that no Jews were saved. The public, by 1944, by the spring of 44, was ready to do something concrete to help the Jews in Europe. President Roosevelt knew it, and yet he made the decision only to grant haven to 982 refugees.
Wow. Now, during this time, when we talk about the Gallup poll, we also had sort of a crescendo of support that was coming from Hollywood and Broadway with this program or pageants they called We Will Not Die. Can you explain what these pageants was? What was the whole purpose and what did it look like?
The Bergson Group was looking for a dramatic way to bring to public attention the plight of the Jews in Europe. And so they came up with the idea of recruiting prominent celebrities, stars of stage and screen, to perform in what was called a pageant, but it was really more like a protest rally, beginning at Madison Square Garden in March of 1943. And it packed the garden. 20,000 people saw that first performance. And there were so many people waiting outside that night that they did, on the spot, they decided to have a second staging of the pageant that night. So a total of 40,000 Americans viewed this event known as We Will Never Die. And many more people learned about it because the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, in those days wrote a weekly syndicated column, and she wrote about We Will Never Die in her column. So a significant part of the American public first became aware of the mass murder of Europe's Jews thanks to the Bergson Group's effort. The idea of recruiting celebrities is an interesting novelty. It was one of the many innovations that the Bergson Group brought to American Jewish political life. Until this point, celebrities from Hollywood and Broadway did not become involved in political or social causes or controversies. This was a brand new tactic. But sure enough, when the Bergson Group began approaching these cultural luminaries, they found a receptive audience. Now, Ben Hecht, the famous playwright, was the key man in this effort. Hecht was an Academy Award-winning playwright and Hollywood screenwriter. And when he became active in the Bergson Group in 1941, he then went to his colleagues in Hollywood and on Broadway and introduce them to the cause of rescue. It was very much a non-political cause. The Bergson Group was able to attract people from both the political right and the political left, a wide variety of intellectuals, of writers, scholars, local government officials, members of the U.S. Congress, and prominent actors whose presence on Bergson Group petitions and in pageants like We Will Never Die brought a lot of attention. I mean, today too, we have cultural figures, Hollywood actors, who cause a stir when they speak out about a political issue. And sometimes we laugh and wonder why we should be paying attention to the political opinions of someone who is not particularly schooled in that field. But the reality of American life for a very long time has been that we are fascinated by our cultural icons. And this was true in the 1940s as well. So when prominent actors and Hollywood producers and Broadway stars became involved in rescue, that brought a lot more attention to the cause. So it was a brilliant move by the Bergson Group and Ben Hecht to reach out to an audience that the mainstream American Jewish organizations had ignored.
When you might need a little bit more time, we only have 2 more minutes, but I would like you to address, did this have any effect on congressional action?
Yes, the Bergson Group's lobbying effort in Congress was extremely important. It was probably the single most important aspect of its campaign. Keep in mind, in those days, there was no organized Jewish lobby in Washington. There was no AIPAC or any of the other groups that we're today familiar with. So when Bergson and his colleagues started going door to door on Capitol Hill and introducing themselves to members of Congress and talking about rescue, this was a completely new style of activism. And it became crucial because when the White House, when President Roosevelt refused to budge on the issue of rescue, then going to Congress, going around the president and going to Congress instead became a very viable alternative for political pressure and action.
This was actually pretty a huge event and sort of set the pattern for what do we call lobbyists nowadays. Because if you want to get something done, you have to have somebody that's, you know, rattling the chains and shaking the cages. So it's a very good point. I just want to, when we come back, we actually want to talk about what did the staff of the Treasury Secretary do to force FDR to create a refugee board. We'll break into that right after the break. So don't go away. You're listening to Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. If you would like to contact us by sending us email, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com, rod@israelnewstalkradio.com. We'll be back right after these short messages.
John O'Vandor.
And I'm Ross Nichols.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind, a show that broadcasts all the weekly goodness that flows like milk and honey from the Holy Land straight into your ears with humorous and happy news stories.
We're going to be talking about...
What are we going to talk about?
A person who takes out a terrorist with a pizza tray.
And there's Donald Trump talking to a turkey. What's that about?
A 71-year-old rock star is a staunch supporter of Israel.
Join us on our program, Israel on My Mind,
every Thursday.
Welcome back to Beyond the Matrix, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
We're in the third and final segment of Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio. Jerry, why don't you go ahead and take it?
Dr. Medoff, what did the staff of Treasury Secretary Morgenthau do that forced FDR to create the War Refugee Board, and how many Holocaust survivors were saved by that action?
There was a remarkable convergence of events in the autumn of 1943. And we've already mentioned that the Bergson Group was taking out big ads in the newspapers, that they brought 400 rabbis to march to the White House, and that they were energetically lobbying on Capitol Hill to get members of Congress interested in the issue of rescue. While all that was going on in the public realm, behind the scenes, there was a remarkable clash going on between the Treasury Department and the State Department. A handful of Treasury Department staff members, not Jews, became aware entirely by accident that the State Department had been deliberately suppressing news that was coming from Europe about the mass slaughter of the Jews and sabotaging opportunities to ransom or rescue Jewish refugees. The Treasury Department officials, led by John Paley and Josiah Du Bois, gathered this information about the State Department's suppression and obstruction, and they brought it to the attention of Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau Jr., who was the only Jewish member of President Roosevelt's cabinet. The Treasury Department people, Morgenthau and his staff, were well aware of what was happening on Capitol Hill. They saw all the agitation by the Bergson Group. And exactly at this moment, while they were discovering what the State Department was doing, the Bergson Group had persuaded members of Congress to introduce a resolution calling on President Roosevelt to create a government agency for the sole purpose of rescuing Jews from the Nazis. And the resolution was gathering steam, especially in the Senate. On the House side, the resolution ran into trouble because the Roosevelt administration made a very serious effort to block its advance. They sent Assistant Secretary of State Breckinridge Long, who was their main point man on immigration refugee issues, they sent him to Capitol Hill to testify against the resolution and to try to convince members of Congress to block it. And he almost succeeded, but he made a number of statements in his testimony that were wild exaggerations of how much America had supposedly done to help Jews until then. And his statements were so extreme and absurd that they were quickly exposed in the press. And even mainstream Jewish organizations that were not at all happy about the Bergson Group, they too jumped in and challenged Breckinridge Long's misstatements. And the whole issue of rescue kind of exploded into the public arena and into controversy, because this major official of the Roosevelt administration was found to have, in effect, lied about the rescue question. That pushed the resolution forward in the Senate. On the Senate side, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in December 1943 adopted the resolution. There, too, by the way, is an extraordinary series of events. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was a Democrat, a loyal Roosevelt supporter. He blocked the resolution. But he was out sick one day. And the day he was out sick, another member of the committee, Senator Elbert Thomas of Utah, also a Democrat, but a strong supporter of rescue and a man who was active in the Bergson Group, he became temporarily the sitting chair of the committee for that day. And he quickly introduced this rescue resolution calling for creation of a government agency. And the resolution passed.
A true you snooze, you lose.
So this remarkable coincidence of events created a climate in Washington of which Secretary Morgenthau and his staff were very aware. And they decided to go to the president with this information. Now, we know from Morgenthau's diaries, and his diaries actually are a series of transcripts of Morgenthau's meetings at the Treasury Department and his conversations with State Department officials. We know from those documents that Morgenthau felt that the pressure being built up in Congress might make it possible for him, Morgenthau, to convince President Roosevelt to do something. Also, Morgenthau was keenly aware that they were on the verge of an election year, 1944, where the president was going to face re-election. And even though he was very popular, there's no guarantee of that he would win. And Morgenthau and his staff felt that this might be the opportunity to get Roosevelt to do something that he otherwise wouldn't have done. So Morgenthau, together with the aforementioned John Paley, went to meet with the president in the Oval Office. This was in January 1944. They presented him with the information they had discovered about the State Department's suppression and obstruction. And they said to him, in effect, Mr. President, if you don't do something, Congress is going to do something on this issue and you'll be embarrassed. And in his private conversations, Morgenthau used the phrase, there's a boiling pot on Capitol Hill. The Senate was going to pass this resolution, it seemed. That would be very embarrassing very embarrassing to the president, because here he had this reputation for caring about the downtrodden, and it would be exposed that he was doing nothing about the Jews who were being slaughtered by the millions in Europe. So President Roosevelt, ever the savvy politician, realized that in this situation, it would be a disaster in an election year to have a huge scandal in which his State Department was found to have engaged in such inappropriate policies regarding the Jews. And so he decided to throw a bone to the rescue advocates. He created the government agency that Congress was demanding. He created it by executive order. So he preempted Congress. It was called the War Refugee Board. Now, FDR never meant the War Refugee Board to be more than a token gesture to try to get his critics off his back on the rescue issue. So he gave it almost no funding, which was remarkable for a government agency. 90% of the War Refugees Board's funds were supplied by American Jewish organizations, mostly by the Joint Distribution Committee and some by the World Jewish Congress and an Orthodox group called the Vod Hatzalah. I don't know of another instance in which a government agency was 90% funded by private American citizens and what we call today NGOs. But that's the fact. The War Refugee Board was never given the proper funding by the government. And the State Department and the War Department rarely cooperated with the War Refugee Board. The White House also often did not cooperate. Despite that, despite these obstacles, the War Refugee Board did amazing work. This is a story that was first told by Professor David Wyman in his famous book, The Abandonment of the Jews, published in 1984. And the story of the War Refugee Board has been told in other books, including two that I wrote over the years. But unfortunately, it's not so well known to the wider public, so it's worth very briefly mentioning what they did. The reason the War Refugee Board was successful to the extent that it was is because the staff who were hired to run it were the same Treasury Department officials who at first discovered and exposed what the State Department was doing to prevent rescue. So these same people, John Paley, who I mentioned, he became executive director of the War Refugee Board. Josiah Du Bois became its chief counsel. And under their leadership, this small but energetic staff carried out near miracles in Europe. And they did it in a number of unconventional and unorthodox ways. They, for example, sent money to Europe, which was given to bribe Nazi officials in certain situations to let Jews go. Not exactly the kind of legal above board activity one might normally expect from a government agency, but these were men cut from a different cloth. They sent funds that were used to shelter Jews by the underground movements in various countries. They brought about the transfer of some 70,000 Jews who were in Romania, who were in the direct path of the retreating German armies in 1944. And everyone knew, that is to say, the War Refugee Board people and others knew from past experience that the retreating German armies frequently carried out mass atrocities against Jews whom they encountered. They brought about the physical removal of 70,000 Jews in Romania, got them out of the way of the retreating German armies, and thereby saved their lives. Perhaps the best known aspect of the War Refugee Board's work was that the board's representative in Sweden recruited Raoul Wallenberg, convinced him to go to Nazi-occupied Budapest, gave him the funds and information he needed to then carry out the incredible life-saving work that we all know Wallenberg undertook in Budapest in the last months of the war. Now, Wallenberg's name is, of course, well-known. The fact that the Wallenberg mission was made possible by the War Refugee Board, and in fact, could not have occurred without the involvement of the War Refugee Board, is of course not well known. And the fact that the War Refugee Board came into existence because of the courageous and sometimes controversial activities of the Bergson Group and the marching rabbis and the Treasury Department officials, well, that's a story that is not well known at all. Now, a number of years ago, my colleagues and I at the David Wyman Institute noted with dismay that the U.S. Holocaust Museum had nothing in its exhibit about the Bergson Group at all. We spent years, it took 5 years of appeals, letters, meetings, protests, petitions, until finally, very grudgingly, the Holocaust Museum installed text in its regular exhibit acknowledging the Bergson Group. Unfortunately, the new exhibit about Americans and the Holocaust, although it does mention the Bergson Group, it does so in a very brief and cursory fashion and does not give adequate credit to its extraordinary accomplishments and especially its connection to the creation of the War Refugee Board.
You know, listening to you during this broadcast, as I told you during the break, it's still a little disconcerting to find out that your sort of idealistic view of a president administration has been sort of crushed. But at the same time, what an inspiration to hear what this board was able to do with minimal amount of government funding, with minimal amount of support from the president or the secretary of state or defense, et cetera. And yet they were able to accomplish this. It should be inspiring for all of us to be able to know when it's time to stand up and do something right, it's worth all the effort that you can put in it. Dr. Madoff, thank you so much for joining us on Beyond the Matrix, and hopefully we'll have you back real soon. Shalom from Beyond the Matrix here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Howdy, this is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Karras from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.